This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. This Sunday marks the 15-year anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The event caused shifts in global political, social, and economic climate and gave birth to lots of new academic scholarship. In advance of the anniversary, Duke University asked some of its scholars to reflect on how their fields of study have been reshaped by 9/11, and we'll talk with three of them today. Joining me first is David Siegel. He's a professor of political science who specializes in political violence and terrorism. David, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about that. Certainly the demand for this kind of scholarship increased dramatically. That would
definitely
be the first change, right? How have things changed in terms of the way we studied terrorism before and after?
Sure. Primarily the changes happened in both scope, and obviously much more attention paid to it. Much more money was devoted to it from the government, which led to more people moving to study it. But also changed sort of qualitatively from a more, well, qualitative study involving, you know, case studies of anti-colonial movements that involved terrorism or nationalist movements that involved terrorism, much more qualitative, psychologically oriented, or, in terms of case studies and historical analyses. And then once the sort of attention got paid much more, you saw a big influx of economists and political scientists moving in to study it more quantitatively, both in terms of sort of methods of analysis that are quantitative and also just data. There's much more data started being developed.
I wonder, do you use in the academy the term terrorism? Because it seems to me that if you start with that as your term, the fix is in. There's bad guys out there, they're doing the bad thing, which might mean you don't examine other forms of violence that could be sort of more under your nose.
No, that's a great question. And there have been many, many, many papers, as you might imagine, written just about the definition of terrorism. There's no, you know, set definition in within the government or between governments. And that has, you know, I spend at least the first day plus talking about the definition of terrorism, right? What is it? The key there is we tend to focus, at least academically, on the method, right? So attacks by weak actors against strong actors that are intended to move audiences as opposed to directly influence an army.
Right. So then again, what you just touched on was that this is a function of asymmetrical warfare.
Yes, and a particular type that has indirect effects on different audiences.
All right. So then now that there's more focus on this, more attention, what are you finding? What do we know about who acts this way, root causes, and whether or not that plays any role in sort of how we would behave after that?
So it's hard because a lot of data are bad and sort of getting better, but it's hard to gather these data. And again, there are questions about what is terrorism. But some things we learn, right? So democracies suffer more terrorism. That was sort of an early measure. Then we spend more time and learn that, okay, what parts of democracy maybe lead to terrorism? And it seems like it's more of a factor of executive constraints that prevent counterterrorism than sort of political participation, making people not want to engage in terrorism. We learn that terrorists are not necessarily like the poorest and the most, you know, sort of uneducated people. They actually are more relative to the rest of the population. They are better educated. They are better off financially, economically.
And so that seems, let me stop you there, because that it might at first blush seem a little bit surprising. You would think that the people most oppressed by the system against which they're fighting would be the most likely and perhaps the most desperate, mm-hmm. and so therefore the most likely to engage in mm-hmm. dangerous behavior.
So why not?
Yeah.
So there are several arguments. My personal favorite, not due to me, but my personal favorite is it's a demand issue, right? So if you are a terrorist group, right, you have a particular activity you want to undertake. It's difficult from a practical perspective. Who do you want to be in your group committing the attacks, right? The most well-educated, the people best able to cross borders, who know more languages, who can blend in better, and those are the people who are better off economically, who have more education. So the pool might expand of potential terrorists when people get more impoverished, but the choice of the terrorist group of who to use is selected at the top.
It also does suggest that it is to some degree then, if this correlates to higher education and better wealth, a rational choice.
Yes, and a lot of this new research I was mentioning in terms of the movement away from sort of purely sort of psychological, not that that's not really important because it is, but the movement towards this sort of quantitative approach has been a very heavily, this is a rational decision on the part of terrorist groups, maybe not each terrorist member, but the groups themselves are doing things for a reason to affect some kind of change, and it's a rational choice to how to do that best for them.
Is this something that can be studied globally as a kind of as a phenomenon, terrorism, or are we better to look at each particular group, its goals, its ambitions, and its methods?
Well, both ideally, but definitely, yes, there are many commonalities. And a lot of the sort of frustrating thing looking at the news now is that you see the assumption that, oh, we're in a different kind of terrorism here, or there's a different kind over here. We can't think about it the same way. It's, you know, Islamic terrorism is somehow very different. But a lot of the things are just common across history, across time, across groups, locations. They have the same methods in a lot of the cases, the same recruitment strategies. So there's a lot of things we can learn from just treating things as a global.
Initially, you talked about democracies being the prime target, and maybe one of the reasons is the restraints on response, executive restraints and sort of popular restraint. Does that mean then that there is that the option for any opponent, a democracy, for instance, would be either to devolve into and use, you know, to become the enemy, to devolve into a terrorist, or remain vulnerable?
Yes. typically, terrorism is very hard to stamp out. It's a lot of the recent attacks, the sort of lone wolf attacks, are almost impossible to actually stop, and they can barely even call them terrorism. They're just someone who wants to commit harm. So yes, I mean, unless you devolve into a sort of an authoritarian police state, you're going to have some terrorism.
Well, we want to talk about the many ways in which 9/11 has affected research. And joining me now is Robin Gerwich. She's a clinical psychologist who specializes in understanding the impact of trauma and disaster on children. Dr. Gerwich, welcome to the State. Thanks. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this. You started looking into this topic actually after the Oklahoma City bombing, right?
Exactly. So I was a very young psychologist in Oklahoma City, and when the Oklahoma City bombing happened, honestly, we didn't know what these events would have and what kind of impact it would have on children. We hadn't had those kinds of events, certainly in the United States, and even globally, there were very few to draw from. So research started, services started, ideas started after Oklahoma City, and it certainly did change me and then change again at 9/11.
So this is, and I may have misidentified you, you're a psychiatrist.
I'm a psychologist.
Psychologist, okay. So we've got that right. So what are we learning now? Because we're talking now about media coverage, in other words, the exposure to the coverage of the event, right?
So we have learned quite a bit in the last 15 years, and one of those things that we have come to understand, or I guess two big points that we need to think about is, one, parents, caregivers, whoever, need to talk to children about these events. Don't assume that they don't listen. Don't assume they don't know. But we really need to have that conversation because it is all over both social media, radio, television. So having those conversations is critical. We also know from in the last 15 years that exposure to media can have an impact. So before 9/11, there was an idea that if children weren't directly involved, we didn't really need to worry. They wouldn't be impacted. 9/11 taught us a big lesson, and we've continued to learn from that, that you don't have to be right there to actually have reactions, to have stress, to have distress, and to want to, and to be impacted by that event. So that's been a big change, and so a lot of efforts have been made on helping parents think about how much exposure do they have their children watch, at what age, and how do they do it with their children.
And, of course, more distressing about 9/11 was that we documented the actual attack, which is rare. We don't, you know, in Oklahoma City, again, we saw the aftermath. But in the case of 9/11, we saw the attack itself played over and over again.
And I think that's been a big change in our technology, because 9/11 we watched and we did see it replay over and over, and that's been similar across terrorist events around the world, that somebody's got a camera and it's there. We saw footage of Boston Marathon of the explosion happening and runners falling. So that has changed dramatically children's views of the event and how we help them understand what's happened.
Well, how so? Because I could make a case on the one hand as a layperson that repeated exposure would be more traumatic, and I could make another lay case that repeated exposure immunizes me and I'm hardly affected at all.
Let's go with that first one.
Okay. All right. Because, that's why we brought on the experts, by the way.
Because what we know is, you know, I think about the song, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. What we know from the research is actually the opposite, that you don't get stronger and stronger the more exposed you are to traumatic events. And so What we do know is for very, very little children, they really shouldn't be watching this at all. They don't have an understanding. If they were impacted, then sit down and talk to them. With older children or teens, watch it in small doses. Sit down with them and make sure that you can have the conversation about what do they understand, how do they make sense of it, and what questions do they have or their friends are talking about, so you can listen and correct misunderstandings. But we know that if we don't talk to kids and we just let them sit and watch over and over and over again, their reactions and their distress will be much harder.
Problem there is they have access to the media themselves.
Absolutely.
In the palm of their hand, right?
Absolutely. And that's why it's so critical that we as adults, in schools, et cetera, sit down and talk to them. What did you see? What are you seeing? What are your friends talking about? What do they understand? Because it's amazing what kind of rumors get going and how they understand what's happening. So talking about it is really the key.
One of the phenomena I was interested to see after 9/11 was the fact that the repeated bombing, watching the building go down over and over, can give a young viewer the sense that this is a series of events and not one event replay.
Right. Very young children don't understand instant replay. So if you think about it, there shouldn't be a building left standing in New York as many times as it replayed. So for very young children who don't understand that this is not happening now, it can be very problematic. So we really do need to take a step back and help them understand, and better yet, turn the TV off.
You do trainings for children and parents and caregivers and also the media, a group I consider uneducable. So what's your advice for us?
For you, the media?
Yeah.
For you, the media. I think taking a step back, recognizing that these events not only impact the people you're covering, but also impact you. Because you have children, you have families, you're part of these events as well, and so you're not immune to it. But I think taking an understanding that as you cover these events, thinking through, what's the story that I want to tell? What's the goal that I want to have at the end of the day? And then taking a step back and thinking, where are my supports? Because covering this all day long does take a toll.
Well, we said we're talking about this from many different points of view, the ways in which scholarship has changed since 9/11. Joining us now is our third scholar, Mark Anthony Neal, is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke, and of course a regular guest on the State of Things Back Channel series. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
You have looked at the impact of 9/11 on popular music. Give us an overview.
I was really struck by this line that gets drawn around 9/11 in terms of social critique and political critique. And, of course, the best example is the Dixie Chicks, who had critiques of George W. Bush prior to 9/11, continued some of those critiques. And it's at a different moment, you know, in terms of the media landscape, particularly around popular music. Artists absolutely need radio at that point in time. And so artists had to think about ways in which their public critique of politics and policy could be read as unpatriotic, right? It's Colin Kaepernick, 15 years ago in that regard. And so that when country music radio decides they're no longer going to play the Dixie Chicks, the Dixie Chicks, for all intents and purposes, disappear as a commercially viable group. And so I think 9/11 raised some interesting questions around that. On the other hand, you think about, Clear Channel, which at the time probably owned about 1,500 stations. Mm-hmm. And someone within their, enterprise sends out a dictate, telling some of the stations, well, we want to be careful about how people are emotionally responding to this. So you take a song like, the group Kansas has a song, Dust in the Wind, classic soft rock thing from the 1970s, they're telling stations not to play that. They're telling stations not to play Carole King's I Felt the Earth Move, not any song that would kind of trigger, if you will, emotionally to what was happening outside, in the world. And it's ironic because I would imagine many folks, thinking about children in this case, what would have been a more safer place to go than soft rock, on the radio if you're trying to shield, young folks in particular from the visuals that are occurring around 9/11.
Well, so obviously in the immediate aftermath, there were a lot of changes and a lot of sort of cautions. I mean, the late night shows just went dark until they could finally figure out a way to talk about this. So we understood that. But what about now in popular music? Do we see any kind of echo and shadow of 9/11?
I think when you think about some of the young artists that drive pop music, Ariana Grande is a good example. I mean, this is someone who was literally a child, you know, when 9/11 occurred. You're not going to hear resonances of it from those kinds of pop artists. But when you think about some of the more veteran artists, who not only were functioning, you know, as artists prior to 9/11, but also had to recalibrate. You know, someone like a Bruce Springsteen, you know, who of course has been engaged in all kinds of social commentary in his music. I think you hear resonances in those kinds of artists, right? Thinking about the kind of limits that there are now in terms of what they can sing about, what they can't sing about. You know, the thing that's important about this landscape is that radio now doesn't play the same kind of role that it did in terms of the recording industry. You know, you think back to Kanye West in 2005 and his comments about George Bush. And there was a real fear that, you know, this moment in Kanye's career wouldn't go forward because there would be some backlash still holding on to the resonances of post 9/11. You know, by the time we get to 2016 and we're looking at streaming music services, you know, artists don't need terrestrial radio in that way anymore. So if there are an artist that wants to be committed to social commentary and social justice critique, you know, there is a way to do that without having to go through these middle institutions and directly connect, you know, to the audience.
Well, David Siegel, I guess this brings me back to the question of our response to terrorism and sort of terrorism as an academic study. We're talking now at this moment about critiques and the way in which they're handled, in some ways muted and then transmuted, changed over time. I wonder if the study of terrorism ever offers a critique on the system against which it's. In other words, do we ever look back and say, the response to this is terrible, immoral, and brutal, but you know they may have something here. I wonder if we change this about us and our approach, we could soften the impact of terrorism.
So one of the important things, I think, is that I think you sort of alluded to this earlier on. Every victor calls their opponents terrorists, and they've done that for, you know, centuries, literally. So it's very difficult. So one of the things I try to do, and I think most scholars try to do, is distance yourself from the normative sort of aspect and say, okay, some of these goals are actually goals you would actually like, right? They're anti-colonial or anti-oppressive, right? It's not about the goals, right? Some of these goals are not right. Some of these goals are good and some are bad, normatively, but you can understand the process differently, right?
Well, I would just think that the reason you would study terrorism is to defend yourself against it, to defend yourself against the harm and destruction. One thing is to build up your military and find ways they sneak in, get a psychological profile, and recognize the cases as they come across your border. Another is to fix the thing they're shooting at because actually it needs fixing.
Yes, and typically, if you look at the actual literature, even if you ignore the normative aspect, the better strategies against terrorism usually are of the latter variety. They're of the variety of fixing the grievances, making things better in that sense, because the military rarely has a long-term, and even the military recognizes this, right? They've moved away from that sort of strict force.
Robin Gurwitch, I want to ask you, too, about sort of the artistic approach in terms of processing. We talked about popular music and responses to horrific events, and I wonder if that's any part of the way in which, when you're working with children, you can help them process, use music, art, and other ways to express what they're feeling.
I think you're right. There are so many avenues to help children express themselves. And certainly, whether it's art or music, are two ways talking about it, creating a meaningful narrative, if you will. And certainly, one of the things we often do is talk to children and say, what music really helps you define? I remember a young boy who lost his father after 9/11 talked about the song by Green Day, Wake Me When September's Over. And although it had nothing to do with 9/11, for this little boy, that spoke to him. And his question was, how do these kids, these young musicians, understand the pain that I'm feeling when my teachers don't? And so I think music does have quite a bit, and we're learning quite a lot in the last 15 years of how children understand and process trauma.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Dr. Robin Gurwitch is a psychologist who specializes in trauma and disaster impact on children. David Siegel is a professor of political science who specializes in political violence and terrorism. And Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke. Thank all of you for being here on the program.
Thank you.
You can find out more information about our scholars at Duke University, and they've got some videos that are also available, Reflections on 9/11. We have all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Jelly Sisoho and Kairo Bob. Stay tuned.